Hello and welcome to Outdoors in Scotland. I'm John Burns and this is my podcast about all things natural and in the outdoor world. One of the strange things I think we as a people have done to ourselves is that if you think about it, over thousands and thousands of years, all of us lived in nature. We were connected to it intimately. We were farmers or we traveled through it, we lived in it, and its rhythms and the way it changed dictated our lives. Only in the last few hundred years, since the Industrial Revolution, I guess, have we kind of severed that link. And there's a lot of people who maybe live in towns and cities whose contact with nature has been dramatically reduced. And part of my life and part of what I've been doing is to write about and to explore how important it is to regain that connection if we can. So my guest today, his book is just out, I believe. It's called Rhythms of Nature, Wildlife and Wild Places Between the Moors. And I thought he'd be a great bloke to have on and talk about this specific issue. So my guest today is Ian Carter. Hello, Ian. How are you doing?
Hi, John. Yeah, I'm really good. Thanks. Really good.
Brilliant, brilliant. Now, your book is just, well, congratulations on having just published your book. It's always a nice thing to get out, isn't it?
It's a good feeling, yeah. So, yeah, when it finally, it takes such a long lead-in time, and when it finally arrives, you see that first copy through the door, it's a great feeling, as you well know.
Yeah. I always compare writing a book to pushing a huge boulder up a hill. And eventually you get to the top of the hill and it rolls away and you have a tremendous sense of relief, you know? So what's Rhythms of Nature about? I said something about the connection of between ourselves and nature. Is that really the essence of the book or is it more than that?
Yeah, it's quite a personal book, I suppose. I mean, I took early retirement about 5 years ago now and was a bit frustrated and disillusioned, I guess, with working in nature conservation. I mean, I enjoyed it. I worked in conservation for 25 years or so, but I did become increasingly frustrated with it, all the bureaucracy, all the strategies, and, you know, quite hard to actually get action on the ground. And this is sort of, in some ways, it's a kind of reconnection with nature. I suddenly had more time to actually get out there, explore the local countryside. I felt I was sort of re-establishing a bond that maybe hadn't been there for quite a few years. And the book is about that and about the ways I sort of found to reconnect with the natural world.
Yeah, one of the things I noticed in your book that you wrote about, which sort of chimes with my experience of wild places, is that you wrote about what it's like to be out at night in a wild place. And I one of the things I do when I visit Bothies or I go camping, and I do think there's a very different character to being in a wild place at night. What do you feel about that?
Absolutely. I think there's two things. There's the nighttime, I think, makes a difference. And also for me, and this has become a little bit of an obsession of sorts, but getting away from the sort of paths and tracks out into open areas of countryside, actually just getting off even the footpath. Mm-hmm. And I think it's because we spend our lives, don't we, kind of constrained by living close to other people, and, you know, even when you go for a walk out in the countryside, you're walking along tracks or footpaths, so the line is determined by decisions made by other people. And actually just stepping away from that, getting off the path, wandering into really wild areas, so you're completely away from all kind of human associations, for me is a really big thing. And the nighttime, I think, exaggerates that or emphasizes that. So not only are you're away from the path, but if you're there overnight, it really does change the atmosphere and change the experience. So yeah, I totally agree with you.
I mean, one of the things I think you mentioned in your book was that at night, the presence of man, the traffic noise, the just sheer activity dies down. And it's like the wild world in terms of owls and mammals like badgers takes over. Has that been your experience too?
Yeah, I think so. I think it's that business about getting away from normal life, normal modern life, which is so dominated by humanity. You know, everywhere you go, the world is dominated by human constructs, and the noise people make and the way we manage a lot of the environment, a lot of the countryside is dominated by people. So trying to get away from that, either by going out when there's less people around, or, as I say, wandering away from the footpaths, it changes your mindset in a really, in an unexpected way. You become more, I guess, sort of dependent on yourself. The dominating influence of other people and all the noise that they make sort of falls away, and that really does change the experience. And yeah, anybody who hasn't sort of done it or isn't used to doing that, I'd really recommend it.
Yeah, I mean, I know there's a lot of people talk about wild camping, which it can be tricky in England, of course, because of your you know the access legislation is different. I'm from Scotland, and we've got a lot more freedom here. And I think for some people, it's actually a bit of an unnerving experience at first to be alone or to be out at night. Is that something you've encountered?
Yes, a little bit actually. Yeah, I totally get that. When you're out in the middle of nowhere and you're 2 miles from the nearest footpath, and who knows how many miles from the nearest human, if something goes wrong, you're kind of on your own. And I think that's one of the reasons why it changes the experience, because for me, your senses become a little bit more heightened, and you're maybe a bit more careful where you're sort of placing your feet, because if you turn your ankle and you're a long way from the path and it's pitch black, then maybe you're gonna struggle a little bit. So that's, I think, one of the reasons why it does change the experience. And it's so worthwhile.
Yeah, and you do tend to, I think at times you can get closer to wild animals. Well, I have a very ambivalent attitude towards the red deer. But one of the things that happens at night certainly is that at night they can't see your outline. And because of that, they are not exactly that they've lost their fear of humans, but they allow you to get an awful lot closer. Are there animals that you've seen at night that you wouldn't ordinarily have seen?
Yeah, just trying to think at night. I think one of the things that helps is it's not just about the sort of darkness, but if you get away again from the path and just sort of sit in an area, whether it's at night or even during the daytime, and I do this quite a lot, I'll just take myself off into a woodland or a section of cliffs looking out to sea. And if you just sit there, and you almost become part of the landscape, and the wildlife actually gets used to that. I've noticed it actually when I've been fishing, and I'm not a great fisherman, but I occasionally do some sea fishing, just sort of spinning for mackerel, and you're standing in the same spot on the beach casting your spinner into the sea, and if you do that for several hours, again, I think the wildlife, they know you're there, and they always know you're there, even if you're trying to sneak up on them, they almost certainly know you're there. They kind of realize you're not much of a threat, and there's this chap there, and he's doing something strange with this rod, but he doesn't seem to be much of a threat. And they then, tend to come a bit closer, and you get much better views. So yeah.
Well, one of the things you also write about is I suppose for want of a better word, gathering food and wild food from nature. Well, tell us a bit about that. What sort of things do you go out and do you collect?
Yeah, all sorts really. I mean, there's all sorts of leaves, berries, fungi, particularly interesting things to collect. And again, I think if you just learn a few species and you spend a bit of time actually going out there looking for them and sort of gathering them and then eating them when you get back home, or even browsing on them when you're out and about. Again, it's a way of deepening that connection with the natural world. So you're not just sort of going out there and looking at the view and maybe looking at the wildlife, but you're actually hunting for specific things. And when you find them, you're then going and sort of actually collecting them and using them. So it's just another way of making that connection with the natural world a little bit stronger.
Yeah, and I think you notice things more, and you as you say, you really need to be how can I put it, a kind of expert on certain things. I mean, obviously, fungi are what most people think about foraging for, but you have to be a bit careful with fungi, don't you?
Absolutely. I'm fascinated by the chemistry of it, actually. I mean, we've obviously evolved along with other plants and animals for hundreds of thousands of years, and the chemistry is interlinked. So, fungi have chemicals in them that are aimed at dissuading things from feeding on them. And yeah, I mean, some fungi are edible, really, really tasty. Some fungi are edible, don't taste particularly good. Some are highly toxic, and if you have one cap of the wrong species, it will kill you in quite a horrid way sometimes. Some of them are toxic to some people, but fine to eat, by the majority. So the majority of people can eat them no problem, but maybe 5% will have a reaction. Some of them are fine to eat, but if you have alcohol at the same time, then you can get a reaction and they become toxic. And there's some strange ones where I'm not sure we have any of these in this country, but certainly in Eastern Europe, there's fungi that become toxic if you exceed a certain threshold. So you can eat them for several days with no problem, and then you get above a certain threshold for the toxin, and it kicks in, and you are then poisoned by them. So the chemistry that's going on there, and the effects that these chemicals in the fungi can have on humans, is fascinating.
Yeah, it did remind me of the time that I was picking parasol mushrooms, and probably should not have done it. I had two large bowls of very delicious mushroom soup, but the result on my digestive system was something I wouldn't like to go into. But that
That's one of them,
again,
I think.
yeah, again,
Yeah,
I believe
that's.
that most people can actually eat parasol mussel mushrooms, no problem. But for a small minority, of which I must be one, they cause a dist a very dis distinct digestive upset. Is that right?
Yeah, well, there's the big parasol. There's a main parasol, which is they can get really big, size of a sort of dinner plate. I think those ones are fine, but there's
Yeah.
another one which is slightly smaller called the shaggy parasol, and that's one of them that normally, I mean, I eat them and most people are absolutely fine, but some people, for whatever reason, because they've got a slightly different body chemistry, have a really bad reaction. So yeah, it's always with any new thing you're eating, it's always worth just having a small amount to start off with and gauge the reaction, and then yeah, tread carefully the first couple of times, I guess.
I think that was the mistake I made. There's another part of your book that interested me, and you talked about reminders of wilderness. And that chimed again with me, because I sort of feel that actually in Britain now we have no true wilderness, really. And our wildlife and our wild land, if you like, has been pushed into the peripheries, into the marginal places. But now and again you can glimpse something, like, I guess you see a wild otter, or you see a badger. Or perhaps an owl, and these are wild creatures, and in that brief moment, you are sort of looking at what I like to call sort of glimpses of wildness. And is that what you meant by reminders of wilderness?
Yeah, I suppose so. I mean, partly it's the connections with the actual animals that are obviously out there and still living completely wild. I mean, even the species that associate closely with us. So, but I've got like a flock of house sparrows knocking around the garden now, and they're very much associated with human structures. But of course, the animal itself is still completely wild. It does its own thing and makes its own decisions. But the wildness thing is, again, it's about as far as is possible to do in this country, getting completely away from normal landscapes to find the wildest corners that are still out there. And they can be quite tough to find, and we have to make do with sort of fragments, and there aren't huge expanses of wilderness like there are still in some countries. You go to America and Canada, there's the big national parks that are you know, essentially untouched natural habitats. We haven't really got that in this country, but no. You can still head out into the middle of a deciduous wood and lose yourself in the middle of it.
Yes.
And all the trees there are native trees, and the birds are the native species, and you can kind of pretend maybe a little bit that you're out there, and you know, the world hasn't been altered by humans. As you know, you can escape from a little bit if you find these forgotten corners and forgotten places.
Yes, that's right. And I think, you know, even if you happen to see even an ant or something, the minutiae that you can look at takes you back to a kind of sort of primitive time, really. I understand what you're saying about some places like Canada and North America, and you kind of forget that sometimes, that you are walking into wilderness. I've only been to America once, and to the Rockies, and to Canada ice climbing, and I did have an encounter like that. I was walking up towards an ice climb in Canada, and I walked through a forest, and I came into a clearing, and as I came into this clearing, a mountain lion walked into the other side of the clearing, and we both yeah, it was an adrenaline causing moment, I have to say.
Yeah.
But it was
go years and years living in places like that and not see them, so it's fantastic that you're able to see one.
Yeah, yeah, it was. I mean, we were about, I don't know, 20 feet apart, and it was. We had this weird moment where we both looked at each other, and it looked at me, and I could see it saying, "Is this guy a threat? No. Is he prey? No, not really." And it just turned and strolled away. It was. I think it was. The only reason I got to see it was there was fresh snow on the ground, which had cushioned the sound of my boots. Without that, yeah. I am sure it would have heard me and been off. So there you go.
That's another thing I think that really does change the experience again of going to places like that, where the top predators that can actually occasionally be a threat to mm-hmm. humans are still mm-hmm. there. So again, it changes the experience. You've got to be a bit more on your toes when there's mountain lions and grizzly bears and things that can actually cause you a problem out there. You kind of become a little bit more alert and aware of your surroundings and aware of your senses. But of course, sadly, all that's long gone. In Britain, we've long since got rid of all the top predators, which is a real shame.
It is. I mean, what's your general view? Obviously, this is a massive question, but I think rewilding is something is talked a lot about, but its progress is very slow. But now we've got threats like about what's happening in Ukraine, which is putting pressure on British farming. How do you feel about the general progress in terms of rewilding or the position that nature has in our environment right now?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of talk at the moment and some progress, but I hope this is just the start, and I hope we can get to the stage where we can set more areas aside there's all sorts of different definitions of rewilding.
Yes.
Exactly what it
yes.
means, and I don't think that matters too much, but for me it means broadly giving nature more of a free role in how things develop. So not actually managing a landscape for a specific conservation goal, but leaving it so things develop more naturally. And yeah, no, I think it would be great if more areas were set aside for that, and they would have all sorts of benefits in terms of benefits for people in terms of visiting and enjoying these areas, seeing how they develop. And of course, but there's the carbon, there's the climate change benefits in terms of absorbing carbon. So, you know, I really hope it's happening. And even with some of the top predators, people in Europe are getting used to being with wolves again, and bears in some cases. So, you know, maybe when we see that and over a longer period of time and see that it's not causing too many problems or the problems can be managed, maybe we'll be a bit bolder when it comes to things like that in this country.
Yeah, I would hope so. I mean, certainly one of the encouraging signs, I think, has been the fairly recent reintroduction of the beaver to places in England. And obviously, you know, I think that'll, I don't know if you agree, but I think it will have a quite a dramatic effect on some of the habitats in certain areas.
Absolutely, yeah. That's one of, it's just one species that's just fantastic at creating habitat, and you know, you can throw things back to nature and let things develop again without having maybe particular goals in mind. But beavers, yeah, they will with their activity of felling trees and the building dams, holding water in place, they will change habitats almost always for the better, despite the scare stories that are out there. So yeah, another species. Sadly, we took it upon ourselves to eliminate entirely, and it's just fantastic that they are coming back now.
Yes, it is. It is. That's one of the more encouraging signs. And I think, I was reading something about the Cairngorm National Park recently, and they're talking about reintroducing beavers there, which I think would be a fantastic thing for some of the things that are going on in some of the glens there in terms of rewilding. The other thing that, well, another animal that I think things are not going so well for is the water vole. They don't seem to be doing too well at all. Is that have you come across that?
Yeah, just you don't see them, do you? I mean, they used to, one of these species that just used to be common, widespread. Yes. People would take for granted, but we have, through the way we've managed habitats and pollution in rivers, the introduced American mink, I think, has caused problems water voles. And yeah, so we fragmented the habitat and reduced them to ever smaller sort of corners. Hopefully, hopefully that can be turned around. And you know, if you got the habitat back in place and dealt with some of the issues with pollution and some of these rewilded areas we were just talking about, then you they would manage to spread back and
Well, that is one of the fascinating things about wildlife, is that whilst it you know, we have literally hammered our wildlife in this in Britain, no two ways about it, but if we take our boot off its throat for a while, the wildlife and the environment has an incredible capacity to recover. Is that something you've noticed?
Absolutely, yeah. No, and that's very true. And I often think, you know, the way you think about wildlife, it depends on what sort of mood you're in, whether you're in and having an optimistic day or a pessimistic day. Because if you're pessimistic, you can think, well, we've trashed most of the really wild habitats in this country. We eliminated all the top predators, and the things like the beaver and wolves and bears that are long gone. So what we've got left is just a sort of poor substitute. But then you think about all the things that there are still actually out there, and you can take a walk in the countryside and see the swallows and house martins flying about. The woods are full of warblers. You've still got your foxes and badgers out there. So we've lost an awful lot, and you can get very depressed about that. But there's so much out there still that is, you know, still out there, and you can still get a lot from. So there's so much left to lose, which is worth fighting for, definitely. And if we can even turn it around and, you know, try and restore some of these habitats, and as you say, the wildlife that's out there will respond, and it will come back.
That's right, and that's obviously one of the major themes of your book, you know, Rhythms of Nature, which I think that's a really good title, because I do feel, one of the things that I notice going out a lot in the hills here is that it is just that rhythm, because the countryside or nature is always changing. It's always moving from summer into autumn into winter, and those are dramatic changes. And that's something I think that we as human beings miss if we're detached from nature. Is that part of what you were trying to say in the book?
Yeah, you can easily become detached from it, can't you? We live in houses, and if you just keep the central heating on through the winter, you know, you barely notice sometimes what the temperature is outside. So the cold, severe weather can almost pass you by. But if you're actually out there day after day, and you do tune into these sort of changes much more, and you notice them much more. And it does, I think it does add a lot to enjoyment of the natural world, the fact that we live in a country where the seasonal changes are so significant. And yeah, if you tune into it and you notice which species arrive in the spring, and then, you know, we lose them in the autumn, but then we get more, an influx of birds, for example, that come for the winter. And if you tune into those changes and notice them, it really adds a lot to, well, to the enjoyment of life, really.
Yeah. Well, listen, Ian, it's been fascinating talking to you. It's a lovely little book, I think. I think it's something I've dipped into, and you find yourself saying, yeah, I agree with that. I feel that way too, you know? And so I really hope you have every success with it. And it's been a very great pleasure talking to you. Thanks very much, Ian.
Okay, no, you're welcome. Good to talk to you.
Well, that was Ian Carter talking about his new book, The Rhythms of Nature. I do hope you've enjoyed listening to the show. If you have, then don't forget to give us a wee follow on Spotify or Google Podcasts or any other platform you care to mention, really. And just before I go, I wanted to say that must be about, I've done over 100 shows now, I suppose. And if you're interested in the outdoors, nature, climbing, hill walking, then do have a little rummage around in my back catalogue. You don't hear offers like that very often, do you? And see, you know, what comes up that you enjoy. I'm sure there'll be lots of interesting stuff that you might like to hear. So I've been John Burns. Do call again. Thanks very much then. Bye-bye.